Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilityism Method series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilityism Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilityism Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Alice Elliott, lecturer in anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. We will be talking about her book, The Outside, Migration as Life in Morocco, recently published by Indiana University Press. Thank you very much, Dr. Elliott, for joining us today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So let's start with the beginnings of your work as an anthropologist. How did you come to anthropology, the anthropology of Morocco, and this book project?
So I came to anthropology by chance, in the sense that I didn't really know what it was when I applied to study it, and then it just kind of happened, and I haven't left yet. So really, my story of engagement with anthropology is one of chance turning out as, you know, as something that became a really important part of my life. And that often is the case, I feel, also when I speak now with applicants to university. Often, you know, the conversations I have is, you know, what is anthropology, and the ways in which, you know, often the engagement with anthropology, at least at first, is often by chance. Anyway, that's a whole other story. So the anthropology of Morocco, my interest in Morocco and my engagement with the country, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book too, very much comes from my own life trajectory. So the region where I grew up in Italy is a region that has seen a lot of migration from Morocco. And it has a very strong ties with Morocco because of decades of movement between the two countries of Moroccan migrants. And I very much grew up with neighbors and family friends, and also people involved in migrant rights activism of my own parents from Morocco. And so people very much involved in my early life that would talk about Morocco in terms of their home, and would describe the ways in which, for example, their visits home in the summer when they were able to visit had shaped their experience both of Morocco but also of Italy. And when I decided to work on Morocco for my PhD, and then other project, and then eventually this book project, it was very much a desire to engage with the kinds of lives that people that were part of my growing up were talking about. And so this book project very much started with me returning to Morocco with, you know, family, friends and neighbors and people I had met through different channels in Italy, who introduced me to their homes back in Morocco. But so that's kind of the why anthropology and Morocco became intersected in my life. But the book project is also in a more kind of, if you will, conceptual sense, but also in a sense of what I think or what I was trying to do with it in anthropology and beyond, was really to try to begin to decenter the ways in which we think about migration. And I do this, first of all, by positioning my ethnographic and conceptual thinking in a place of departure rather than arrival. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more later in the interview. But basically taking very seriously the work, especially of Abdelmalek Sayad, a really prominent thinker that has really influenced my own thinking about migration. Sayad was a sociologist of migration, focused mainly on migration of between Algeria and France, but really taking as an important step in rethinking what migration is and does, and the deadly consequences of specific expectations and imaginations of what migration is and does when they trickle down or up into, for example, policy and migration laws and regulations, by tracing the ways in which migration is experienced in places of departure. So that was really the impetus behind the book project, to try and rethink migration and its experience, but also its theorization from the perspective of places of departure and you know, squarely positioning my thinking about migration in a place of departure, and tracing the theorizations and expectations and experiences of migration of people who live in the midst, in the presence of migration in a place of departure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great to know. It's always very helpful to see, you know, how a project came to be. And I want to ask you about The Outside, which is in the title of your book. So you take The Outside as an analytic that permeates everyday life in Morocco. And, you know, you use this concept rather than focusing on migration as a concept. And I'm wondering how your time during your fieldwork helped you arrive at this framework, and what does this analytical reorientation implicate for migration studies?
Yes, my kind of decision to orient my engagement with migration and through the idea of The Outside very much comes from my ethnographic experience. So my realization when I was living in Morocco for my doctoral fieldwork, that yes, there are, you know, classic concepts in Arabic and even Moroccan dialect that refer to migration and migrants. So for example, the word hijra, so, you know, the idea of migration. But when people would be speaking about their own loved ones, family members, or their own projects of migration, it was through concepts like The Outside or similar kind of synonyms of the idea of The Outside, that these ideas and experiences and theorizations of migration also would come out. So the first kind of very both basic and I think fundamental reason why I focus on the idea of The Outside to understand migration in Morocco is because that's the concept that I encountered most powerfully during my fieldwork and in kind of my engagement with the country and with Moroccan interlocutors and friends and so on. But there's also kind of by doing this, my hope was also from the beginning to kind of challenge the kind of naturalized assumptions that I feel often inform understandings of migration, especially in terms of the reasons, so the causes and effects of migration and the ways in which migratory movement is theorized, but also the ways in which migratory movement is controlled and, regulated by different forces. So part of my kind of push and impulse to focus on the outside as a concept was to try and undo the assumption that basically when we talk about migration, the researcher, the people the researcher works with, and the reader all share an understanding of what migration is, does, and means, and no more either conceptual, ethnographic, political, personal work is needed, because we all know what we're talking about. Now let's move on to think of what causes is, or according to where you're coming from, how we control it or how we make it better or worse or so on. So it was also an attempt to kind of remind, first of all, myself that migration requires much more, if you will, hard work and much more intellectual humility to understand and trace the theorizations that people who are involved in transnational and local different forms of movement are doing all the time in order to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm very glad that you have done that, because, yeah, I mean, personally, as a reader, one thing that frustrates me is when authors take for granted concepts like migrants or refugees, and we all know what it means, and it kind of becomes a blanket concept. So I'm very glad you did this conceptual work. And out of this conceptual work, you veer into other theoretical threads like temporality, which I was very excited about. So you show us that the outside structures and destructures time in Tadla through major life events, individual bodies, and intimate life moments. Could you tell our listeners about these ideas and especially the tempos of life with respect to the outside?
I found the temporality a really important way through which to begin to understand and trace the multiple presences that the outside / migration in understood through the lens of the outside has in places of departure, such as the area of Morocco where I do my research. And temporality is, I think, as other authors have already argued, temporality, I think, is a fundamental way to understand the experience of migration, but also the ways in which migration is regulated and the ways in which, policies and laws kind of administer life, death, hope through the controlling of certain temporalities, for example, from visa applications to amount of time that one has to wait outside a police office to get their residence permit renewed and so on. My interest in paying attention to temporality in the Tadla, the area of Morocco where I work, was because I felt it really revealed the ways in which migration works in and through specific relations and bodies and everyday, even just gestures, and the ways in which also people themselves, of course, so this is not a one-way process where people are kind of passive towards the force of migration. So people are also, molding and intersecting migration in their own ways and through different, everyday practices, but focusing on how the outside intersect with very mundane practices. So, the ways in which you brush your hair or the ways in which you prepare yourself for the day in the presence of, for example, a migrant husband that is supposed to return, or a child that will be calling from Italy or Spain, or money that will be arriving from Germany. And the ways in which these events in the outside really permeate the way in which life in its most granular sense is organized and is experienced. So tracing the ways in which temporality, so both the ways in which migration acquires a specific temporal texture in places of departure, but also the ways in which migration intersects and often interferes with temporalities that are expected and definitely desired to be of a specific rhythm and duration and so on. So I look at temporality and in the ways in which migration, you know, takes on a temporal dimension, both by tracing, for example, how the possibility, you know, weddings and funerals and circumcision parties are organized around specific temporalities of the outside, from like the expectation of the reply to a visa application, but also to national holidays in Italy and Spain, when the father of the child, for example, is hoped to be able to return for a specific party or event. But also, as I was mentioning earlier, also in very kind of small everyday gestures. And I really try throughout the book to take seriously, you know, Abu Lugod's understanding of ethnographies of the particular, also in the sense of seeing ethnographies of the particular as being able to provide more and deeper understanding of quote-unquote grand events and socio-economic, socio-political phenomena such as migration. So in a way, my argument is like tracing how the phenomenon of migration trickles down and intersects with the very way in which a woman may decide, you know, how to prepare herself for the day is not a kind of a quaint, sweet detail that we can just read, smile at, and move on secure and safe in our own understanding of what migration is that does, but actually reveals a whole different dimension and demands specific type of conceptual and ethnographic work in order to be re-understood in the case of migration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And also in terms of temporality, I found your work sort of very productive, like rather than, you know, seeing temporality as something in which people are stuck, which is often the case in works of migration, you show us how it produces life, not only in, you know, spaces of arrival, but spaces that people circulate in, you know, homes that people come back to. So I found that aspect very fascinating. I want to ask you a little bit more about the outside, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Tabla, where you did your field work, for our listeners who might not be familiar with Morocco.
Yes, of course, yes. And maybe I should also mention that, you know, the whole idea of the work, I mean, I mentioned it a bit with your first question, is to try and kind of trace what migration looks like, what it feels, what its experience is in a place of departure. Mm-hmm. So my choice to work in this area of Morocco, which is a rural area of Morocco, of central Morocco, at the feet of the Atlas Mountains. This is an area that is today quite notorious in Morocco as a place where migrants leave for southern Europe, especially Italy and Spain. So it's not an area of, one could say, traditional emigration, as is the north of Morocco and actually the very south of Morocco. And of course, Morocco has a very long history of migration and movement, very much intertwined with a history of colonialism. And so, you know, classic countries of arrival, like France and Germany and the Netherlands, but especially France and Spain in relation to colonial histories, shared colonial histories. So there are places in Morocco that are kind of classic places of emigration. And the area where I work, this rural area of central Morocco, the Tadla region, is an area that from which migration started a little later than other areas of the country. And migration was oriented towards not the classic places of migration, as I said, France and so on, but countries in Southern Europe, most like specifically Italy and Spain. And this is because migration started in this region when other countries were starting to tighten border control. And countries like Italy and Spain still had a more kind of open-ended immigration policy, or you could say they hadn't yet kind of aligned to other countries the ways in which they were applying immigration control. So it's a very interesting region of Morocco in the sense of thinking of how a more recent, wave of emigration has actually transformed the region very quickly to become today one, as I mentioned, one of the regions that is seen as the main sending area of the whole country, and Morocco being one of the main sending areas, so one of the main countries of emigration in the world, makes also this region one of the main emigration regions of the world.
Yeah, thank you for providing this background for our listeners. And my next question is about storytelling and knowledge. So in the book, you show us that knowledge about the outside is produced through stories and storytelling, but also through haziness about the lives of loved ones living in the outside. So what does the juxtaposition of these forms of knowing tell us about how migration shapes life in Tadla?
Yes, thank you for this question. It's a really important one, and one that I've tried to explore in the book in a way that takes seriously storytelling and story sharing as a really important form of the production of knowledge. I'm very much influenced, as is the whole book as a whole, by the work of Abdelmalek Sayad and his work on Algerian migration to France. And he has a big discussion of the ways in which knowledge about migration is created collectively between migrants, so people who have left, and their neighbors and family members who are non-migrants. And he uses this term that I have a problem with. I mean, I find it difficult to say that I have a problem with anything Sayad has written, given that he's like, you know, the big inspiration of all my work. But he uses the terminology of collective lie. And while the language of lying, I don't think is helpful in the context I'm working with, the idea of collectivity and the ways in which, you know, knowledge about, for example, what lies at the other side of the Mediterranean Sea is never absolute and is always relational and is generated by the intersection of the experiences of migrants, for example, visiting home in the summer months when possible, and also the expectations of their friends and relatives and neighbors, and the ways in which knowledge about a migration, or about, you know, Italy, for example, in the case of my work, or France in the case of Sayad's work, is not necessarily something that, you know, migrants bring back and relate in kind of an early news report and quite, you know, kind of abstract way. The ways what Sayad traces is that actually the migrants are often allowed, in inverted commas, to report only certain dimensions of their lives as migrants, so when they're in the outside. And not only are they allowed, but they're also often willing only to report certain dimensions of that life, because the expectations of people around them is to recount those sides of the story. So in the book, I try to trace the ways in which knowledge about the outside is generated relationally. And I also try to trace, as you pick up in your question, the intersection of having incredibly precise knowledge. So, for example, you know, the knowledge that people in Morocco will have, for example, on Italian migration law or dates of specific changes to visa applications, or, you know, knowledges about specific police stations in a specific town in northern Italy that is known for being a bit more humane, for want of a better word, in the ways in which they renew residence permits versus another. So there's extreme precise knowledge, but this is combined with a kind of, I would say, willingness to be also a little vague in the ways in which, for example, your own family members, the ways in which your own family members live in the outside. And I discuss how this vagueness is both tactical in a way, in the sense that there are a lot of stereotypes about the kinds of jobs and the kinds of degrading conditions some migrants have to endure in the outside. But I think my argument is also that this vagueness about the modes of life in the outside is also connected to the fact that what really counts and matters is the relation with the outside, is the fact that the family member is in the outside, and what they do in the outside is kind of less importance. But I also wanted to say that this question of the collective making of knowledge, so is important also for the ways in which people in the region are very explicit about the fact that they know very well that life is hard in the outside. Mm. And I think this keenness to specify that they are basically not the, you know, the gullible peasants, mm-hmm. that not only, you know, Italy and Spain, but also their own co-nationals in urban centers like Rabat and Casablanca imagine them to be. So there's a very very explicit reiteration of the fact that, you know, people will tell me, you know, we know that in Europe, you know, it's hard, that even if you have 5 degrees, you'll probably end up working in a construction site. We know about racist police on the streets. And this, so basically, it's made as a point of even like as an important point to explain to others, include first of all to their own, you know, other Moroccans from more urban centers, that there's nothing, you know, naive about these transactional movements. If anything, there's a deep knowledge of the complexities and difficulties involved in this movement to the outside.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because one part of your work I found so powerful was that, you know, I think you're really decentering this assumption that, you know, people in the global south really aspire to, you know, Europe or the US, and, you know, see these places as, you know, perfect ideals to get to, and, your work really powerfully shows us that this is not the case. And people from, you know, rural Morocco or other regions are active producers of this kind of knowledge about those places. So I really appreciated that. Another part of your work that stuck with me was one of these quotes from Salima, one of your interlocutors. She says, "I'm married to the outside," when she talks about her husband to you. So can you tell us more about how the outside mediates marriage? And how does this dimension of your work speak to gender literature on spouses left behind, so to speak, by migrants who leave?
Yes. So the outside and migration more generally mediates marriage in a number of different and extremely powerful ways. And the book goes through the most obvious ones. So from the fact that, entry into Europe currently, basically without a family reunification visa or equivalent, is basically impossible. So I think it's, first of all, important to, you know, make clear and be explicit about, you know, all the kind of media attention to, for example, visa marriages and the kind of attention to how marriage can be used to, as a way to obtain specific types of rights that, by the way, other people have without needing to, for example, marry someone. It's really important to connect the ways in which migration laws and policies somehow, well, first of all, are incredibly patriarchal and very much based and imagined around the heterosexual family. So in many ways, for women, especially in the current moment, entry into Italy and Spain is often incredibly hard to do without having, you know, a family member, and a very close family member, so not a cousin or sometimes even, say, a grandchild, but basically a husband in Europe. So all this to say that the relationship between marriage and migration intersects very powerfully with the ways in which marriage figures so prominently in the imagination of migrants at the heart of migration policies. But the ways in which you see the effects of this in the Tadla is a different level. So I trace both the ways in which migrant men are considered kind of generally kind of a good marriage match for the kinds of possibilities that they open for the outside. But I also try a bit like how you picked up really well, and you put it much better than I do. I think, you know, my attempt to both tracing, for example, you know, the importance of the outside in people's lives, but also tracing how this outside is co-produced by local ideas and is not kind of this overwhelming force that kind of crushes. If anything, it emerges from the theorizations and experiences of the people themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the same case with marriage. So on the one hand, there is a very clear understanding that one of the few ways to make it into Europe is through marriage to a migrant, but also there's very clear understandings and discussions and analysis of the problems that marriage with a migrant brings. First of all, the long and often incredibly long periods of absence and of loneliness and or separation from your loved one or from the person you have married. And I bring this up because your question about, you know, this concept of the left behind, which mm-hmm. is incredibly prominent in the migration and also development literature. Mm-hmm. And I find it very interesting that even the language itself of the left behind, especially applied to women, I mean, my feminist censor is very aware of the real problems of, you know, categorizing, you know, women as left behind by virtue of the status of their husbands. But what's interesting about the literature is that often women married to immigrants, so women whose spouse live in another country and who are often waiting to migrate themselves, but they haven't yet, are often seen as kind of perfect ground, if you will, to evaluate things such as female empowerment. Mm. And often there's a lot of literature that traces how, for example, you know, women married to immigrant men who are not in the country often acquire new responsibilities, new types of jobs, are more involved in kind of bureaucratic life behind the household. And this is seen often as a kind of quote unquote good sign for, you know, female empowerment in an area of departure, so in immigrant areas. And I try in the book to really interrogate this, I think, quite simplistic assumption, and very much, you know, guided by the late Saba Mahmoud's work on really interrogating what does freedom and empowerment, especially in gendered terms, means and looks like for the people themselves. And often in the literature, there's a sense that, you know, being married to a migrant will have good or bad impact on your own independence, for example, back home. And I try in the book to trace how actually concepts such as empowerment are not necessarily the most urgent concepts that the women I know and work with are engaging with. You know, as waiting and hoping for a married life that is considered normal to begin is often the main preoccupation, and what, you know, fills in days, weeks, and months and years of women who are hoping for their married life to begin in the way that they had imagined it to, which generally would mean for them to be able to also travel to Europe and begin a life there. So I think this idea of the left behind is very fertile for specific types of studies that take ideas of female empowerment and freedom as a bit like we were discussing before, as migration, as something that we already and all know and all share what it does and means. And in my work, I try to kind of take a step back from those, you know, assumptions and actually try to engage with the more urgent preoccupations of the people that I know and I have worked with and who, you know, have taught me different ways of understanding these concepts and debates.
Fascinating. Now that we've talked a bit about the assumptions around those left behind, I am also curious about those who return, especially men who return to Tatla from the outside. So how the expectations around mobility and immobility for those who return intersect with masculinity?
Yes, so I have a chapter on basically that traces the return of a migrant to a family that I know very well. And I basically in the chapter I trace the return visit of a migrant from Europe, from Italy specifically, and the consequences of this visit. And what I try to trace are the complexities of return. So as much as return is something of huge importance in, you know, migration stories and experiences, what I try to show is also the kind of underpinning tensions and of someone returning and having to engage with the kinds of expectations and requirements and judgments and observations of those who are not migrants, but that are observing through your own way of being, your body, your attitude, your way of spending or not spending money, the way you walk in the street, the way in which you decide to renovate or not renovate your house, are evaluating the ways in which you have encountered the outside and the ways in which you have, well, in many ways, embodied it in a way that is recognizable and acceptable. And this very, and I trace especially how these evaluations blend and kind of shape and very much with conceptions and expectations around gender and the ways in which especially expectations around masculinity and the ways in which those who identify themselves as men are expected to be, and the ways in which once you have also become a migrant, these expectations of you as a man become coupled with expectations of you as a migrant, coupled in such a powerful way that if, as in the case I trace in my book, if once you return, you're not able to, I suppose, deliver or provide the kinds of behaviors and gestures and actions that people expect of you as a migrant, their understanding of you also become, the understanding of you as a gendered subject comes also under scrutiny. And it's an attempt also to address the kind of very difficult, some would argue nearly impossible, situation in which migrants find themselves when they return home, and also to suggest that sometimes leaving regularly for the outside becomes a way to also maintain good relations with, if you will, the inside or your home.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now that we discussed mobility and your contributions to the migration literature, I want to turn to your methodology, which is, you know, very closely related to how you came to these innovations. So instead of focusing on those on the move to understand mobility across borders, you focus on those who stay put. And can you speak to how this focus contributes to methodologies of migration and to ethnographic methods more broadly?
As I say at the beginning of this conversation, my work is very much influenced and kind of inspired by the work of Abdelmalek Sayad, an Algerian sociologist of migration that really puts at the heart of his work and insists through the incredible number of publications he produced throughout his life of the importance of seeing migration as a, what he says, in a very, one could say, anthropological way, a total social fact. So something that permeates all aspects of life. Mm. And he makes this argument to present and, if you will, rehumanize in the kind of literature and scholarly debates that he is engaging with in his time, the migrant, especially the North African migrant in France. But one of the most powerful, both simple and powerful ways in which he makes this argument of migration as a total social fact is by arguing that an immigrant is always also an emigrant. So, and he argues that if we do not understand migration as something that has an origin, both historical, so for example, in the case of Algeria, but also Morocco, with deep colonial roots, for example, we miss a whole chunk of the picture, not only of both of migration as a phenomenon, as a socioeconomic, cultural phenomenon, but also as the migrant, him or her or themselves. So what he suggests is that if we need to see migration as a total social fact, and one of the most important ways to do that is to consider places of departure and not only places of arrival. And what I take from his work that is really important is, you know, you ask about methodology. One of his central points is that shifting our understanding to include in our theorization of migration also places of departure is not just, quote unquote, a methodological move. I say quote unquote on just because, of course, for me, method is theory, so it's one and the same. But the argument he's making that it's not just like, say, we learn, we have more information about migration, but we are actually, you know, decentering the very understanding of what migration is. Mm-hmm. And we're also, therefore, interrogating dominant understandings of migration, because by including methodologically places of departure, we are also then requiring a rewiring mm-hmm. of our, you know, naturalized assumptions of what migration is and does. And, you know, Syed and, of course, others argue that, for example, migration studies and the theorizations of migration, but also the policy thinking around migration is generally, if not always, made from the point of view of country of so-called arrival. So, you know, what are called in the literature receiving countries. And this means that, you know, issues around migration are always seen in terms of the country of arrival, which, of course, are often specific types of country with specific types of colonial history, specific types of racial relations with mm-hmm. the migrants. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, you know, questions, for example, of assimilation of migrants, or like really fundamental theories that everybody claims we've moved beyond, but we haven't, of migration seen in terms of a push of poverty and pull of wealth. So push-pull theories that dominate the understanding of migration, definitely at the policy-making level still today, are so powerful because migration is basically imagined also conceptually, both conceptually and experientially, and as a problem of policy, if you will, from the perspective of arrival. So for me, it was very important to decenter this approach to migration. And the most powerful way that I know how to do decentering, because of my training as an anthropologist, is through ethnography. And basically by positioning my ethnographic understanding in a place of departure was an attempt to, for a beginning, I'm not claiming I've done it. I feel I'm trying, and I'm starting to kind of decenter the very ways in which we understand, you know, the method, but also the thinking around migration.
Well, I think it's an amazing start. And I think, you know, it's way beyond an attempt. I'm very glad you took on this work. And throughout the book, as an ethnographer, we see you negotiating multiple positions as guest, as roommate, as friend, among others. How did you grapple with positionality as you conducted multi-sited, multi-scalar, and multi-layered fieldwork in your words?
Yes, positionality is a really interesting question. And I address this in the introduction of the book, but also I do try throughout the book to be present and to be open about the complexities of, you know, my position at different scales and in different moments. And the thing about positionality, and I write this in the introduction, is what I've learned, I suppose, with this work is just how deeply relational positionality is. So there's obvious markers of identity that I think are both nearly cliche, but also important, also politically, to acknowledge. So, for example, one's positioning, in my case, as a Southern European in a North African context, as someone who identifies as a woman, as someone who, most importantly for this type of work, as someone who has access to movement, and therefore the glaring disparities that have very deadly consequences on my ability to move vis-a-vis the inability to move of a lot of the people I work with and with whom I have now like decades of friendships and relationships. So that kind of positionality in terms, if you will, of power, privilege, but also different kind of histories that one brings to the table when one engages with research are really important to acknowledge. And I think it's fundamental that one does so, and I do this. But I think it's also important to kind of acknowledge how these positions are never, even the kind of classic identity markers, are deeply relational. And basically, your positionality also changes in relation to the person you are engaging with. And the weight of specific identity markers, if you will, shifts in different, you know, moments, both during the ethnography, but also during the writing process, during the reflection of what you've written, and during, you know, for, by now, a very kind of long-term engagement with friends and research participants and interlocutors in Morocco. And I say this because I think one of the things I've realized by having engaged, by basically taking ages to finish this book, so having it in my life for a very long time, is that I realized how, you know, certain things that I first experienced as a, you know, for example, as a young, even undergraduate student, I see now very differently because of things that have also happened in my own life. So, for example, I mentioned in the introduction how a lot of stories I collected when I lived in Morocco as a doctoral student about miscarriages and pregnancies and the ways in which migration intersects the very experience of reproduction and having children, and also the many stories of women who framed their repeated miscarriages, for example, in terms of a very strong, powerful absence of migrant husbands and the support and love and family life that offers. My understanding of these kinds of experiences, for example, really shifted actually while I was already in the process of writing the book, when I myself had two miscarriages. And I started looking back at these interviews that I had collected, some of them nearly a decade previously, because this is a very long-term work. And I started seeing how my positioning, if you will, going back to your question of positionality towards these stories and the effects they had also physically, if you will, in rereading them in light of my experience, had developed. Now, this is not to say that because I also experienced, you know, pregnancy and loss, my understanding is, if you will, better or more, you know, conclusive than my understanding when I first started this project. And I do actually have a problem in the idea that shared experience alone, taking away, you know, for example, the different forms of experience, privilege, racial hierarchies, and so on, access to movement is problematic. But at the same time, it's an attempt to explain how I understand positionality as something that is never fixed and something that is both relational and also that develops and transforms and changes through time. Also through the critical rethinking of your own work as an anthropologist. Sorry, that was a very long answer to a short question.
No, this was an amazing answer, and thank you very much for, you know, not only giving us a lot to think with in terms of positionality, but also sharing a bit of you with us. My last question is about what is next for you. What are some new projects, questions, issues that you're grappling with right now, if you have been able to, the pandemic?
I think, this is a really important question. And if I have to be honest about my, my answer, is my hope is to take like a deep breath and kind of to take time to, you know, regroup and rethink. The book was just published last month. And as I mentioned, it's a project that has been in my life for a very long time. And I think often in academia, we don't feel we're really allowed to say that we need some rest and we need some time and we need some the right to move slowly. And often I think there's this pressure, and I'm sure, you know, one feels it at all stages of encounter with academic life, that, you know, the pressure to do a project, but also to think what comes next. So on the one hand, my plan is to take some time to think and to kind of allow myself to do some slow thinking. On the other hand, of course, you mentioned the pandemic. So many things have happened in my own life and in the lives of people with whom I have become incredibly connected because of anthropology and because of my work. And one thing that I've been thinking about a lot, and is probably going to be the next, you know, project that I want to work with collaboratively with others, is to trace the experience of lockdown in especially in Italy and Morocco, which are the two countries where I have you know, the most connections with, in the context of migration. So, for example, in Italy, a group of young migrant activists, which I've been involved with for many, many years, have just produced some work on racial profiling that happened in Italy during lockdown, and the ways in which migrants, but also Italians not identified as Italians, the ways in which national lockdown has impacted their lives and has taken the form often of basically explicit racial profiling in their encounters with the authorities. And also on the other side, a lot of my of long-term friends, we've been sharing experiences of lockdown. And in Morocco, there was, I wrote this down because I always get the name, there's been a state of health emergency in Morocco that was declared in March 2020 and has been already renewed 13 times. And so this, which means as quite, depends on the city, but relatively strict, you know, curfews and so on. So life being quite constricted by powerful forces of the state, plus your own experience of the pandemic itself and the precautions that you're taking. So definitely I'm thinking, you know, with friends and both in Morocco and Italy, in the both similar and different ways in which lockdown is experienced, and for countries that are coming out of lockdown, the kind of aftermath of lockdown, especially in lives that kind of came under scrutiny during the state lockdowns, and the kind of understandings of how bodies should be organized and policed in a moment of crisis. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Elliott, for joining us and for your insights and for reminding us that it's okay to take some rest.
Thank you very much.
I'm your host, Aliza Arıca. This discussion of The Outside, Migration as Life in Morocco, published by Indiana University Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.